Is there some way in which we could mobilize a moral cause that we could defend on intellectual grounds, like reducing poverty, increasing lifespan? Is there a way in which we could make human flourishing, human progress, kind of cool and inspiring?
Welcome to Cambridge Forum from First Parish in Harvard Square. We're delighted to bring you Fareed Zakaria talking about his new book, Age of Revolutions, Progress and Backlash from 1600 to the Present, with Steven Pinker, Professor of Psychology at Harvard. We are grateful to Harvard Bookstore for partnering with us in this event.
Thank you. Despite the fact that we live longer, we're richer, we're freer, we have access to more information, to more culture, to more opportunities to enjoy. People feel they're missing something, some kind of meaning and purpose that was previously provided by religion, by patriotism, by tribalism. And a question is, I'm often mystified by the idea that with all of this progress, there is nothing to believe in, to devote your life to find meaning and purpose in, because it would seem to me that if we got rid of war, if we got rid of extreme poverty, which we were and probably are on the path to doing, if we increased human rights and freedom, if we've already doubled our lifespan, we could increase it even further. If we stop kids from dying, if we stop mothers from dying in childbirth, if we allow everyone to have the not just necessities, but a lot of the luxuries of life, I think that's pretty inspiring. And if we get rid of war, what's so funny about life, love, peace, and understanding? But somehow, with some exceptions, that humanistic agenda, that is, make people better off, make them happier and healthier, doesn't seem to get the blood pumping as much as a stirring anthem and conquest and a strong charismatic leader and ancient scripture and so on. Is there a way in which we could make human flourishing, human progress kind of cool and inspiring? So when the Salk vaccine was shown to be effective in the 50s, and the scourge of polio was going to be eliminated, church bells rang and factory whistles blew and strangers hugged each other on the streets. When the Berlin Wall fell, there were ecstatic celebrations. Leonard Bernstein conducted the Beethoven's Ninth, is the Ode to Joy, with an international orchestra. And the Ode to Joy then became the anthem of the European Union. I think there was some global substitute for patriotism in the early years of the United Nations, the iconography of the flag and the beautiful modern building of the headquarters that seemed inspiring. The civil rights movement certainly got people excited and feeling flush, even with goosebumps during its triumphs. Is there some way in which we could mobilize a moral cause that we could defend on intellectual grounds, like reducing poverty, increasing lifespan, but give it the trappings, the symbolism, the iconography that amasses mass movements?
Right. Well, I mean, as you know, this is the thing I wrestle with in the conclusion of the book. And at least historically, there is something that human beings love about devoting themselves to a cause much greater than their own, and a cause that has a kind of mysticism and tradition to it. Think about this building. Think about all the great cathedrals of Europe. Think about all the great symphonies, all the great temples in the world. So much of the greatest art that has ever been built has been built in service of this idea of an awesome God whose wonder you cannot understand, but you stand in service of. Every war, as you say, has been kind of infused with this sense of nationalist pride and patriotic glory. The problem fundamentally, I think, is that the great achievement of Enlightenment liberalism is to say, you have always been told what the meaning of life is by your church, by your ruler,
by the state. We're not going to do that. We're going to tell you that it's up to you to figure out what the meaning of life is. That's your personal quest. And as long as it doesn't oppress anybody else, it can be whatever you want. If for you it's yoga, great. If it's for you it's woodworking, great. If it's for you it's And while that sounds incredibly liberating, there is something about it that people find very unsatisfying and even anxiety-producing. You know, Kierkegaard says anxiety is the dizziness of freedom. And a great psychologist, Eric Fromm, whose work I love, wrote a book called Escape from Freedom. And he talks about how, that the burden of being told this is your challenge leaves a lot of people feeling, I'd rather consult the Bible. I'd rather consult the Quran. I'd rather go back to something familiar, rooted. And that's the part I think it's hard to figure out what liberalism does about, because it is inherent in the liberal project to say, no, that's your business. I'm not going to tell you what it should be. And, that's Jefferson's pursuit of happiness. And it turns out it's something we like the idea of, but we feel deeply unsettled by it. I think I would add to it one piece here, which is so much, it seems to me, of what people react against is at some level the psychological sense of the uncertainty. You don't know whether there's a God, you don't know whether there's an afterlife, you don't know whether you are going to be punished or rewarded. But in the tangible sense, what you lose are custom, tradition, and community. So think about a steel town. The steel mill goes away. The data shows that for the most part, people don't suffer economically, particularly after a few years. They find new jobs. But what the steel town represents is the collapse of your life, your community, your traditions. So maybe you had, a church that you went to where all the people who worked in the steel plant went to. Well, church attendance starts going down. There was a Rotary Club or a Kiwanis Club that was part of it. That disappears. There was a bowling league where everyone went, after work. That goes away. Well, there used to be a hardware store everyone went to. That Home Depot has taken care of that. Maybe there was a bookstore in some towns. Amazon has taken care of that. There's a movie theater you'd go to. Netflix has taken care of that. So what you're left with is you're maybe richer, maybe freer, but you're lonely. And that loneliness actually exacerbates this feeling, this desire to find something you can latch on to. And that is where populism comes in. That is where Trump's meetings are now like religious revivals. There was a very good piece in the New York Times about how it is consciously designed to evoke, a kind of evangelical prayer meeting. And so much of the rhetoric around it has that feeling of, we are going to take you back to that world where we can all be one. And of course, one of the things that has often created community in human history is separation from the other, right? And so there is always another. In Trump's 2016 campaign, he'd speak for an hour, but I can summarize for you in four lines what his message was. The Chinese are taking away your factories, the Mexicans are taking away your jobs, the Muslims are trying to kill you, I'll beat them all up, right? There's a community there around those three foreign others.
Another way of putting this point, it's true that the small, close-knit, socially dense communities had some things that we can easily be nostalgic for. On the other hand, if you go back to the reports of people who lived in those villages and those close-knit communities, they couldn't wait to get out, a lot of them. A lot of 19th century novels talk about, especially when the protagonist is a woman, the stultifying networks of gossip and reputation. If your sister got pregnant, the entire family is shamed and your life is ruined. If you're a young man, you had to go into your father's job in the factory. And so Bruce Springsteen writes songs about escaping in a convertible with your girlfriend and leaving the town as fast as you can. So people chafed under all of those intimate, close-knit social networks, including having your family choose your spouse. But I don't think any of us would exchange the freedom even for the security of greater happiness of someone making a choice for us. And likewise, Berlin talked about other inherent trade-offs, especially ones where the cost of freedom is greater inequality, because if people can exercise their talents and ambitions, some of them are more talented and ambitious than others, it's inevitable that there will be inequality. There are trade-offs with well-being. If you can do what you want, you have the freedom to screw up your lives. And so the aspiration for a perfect society is what leads to dystopian nightmares.
Well, I grew up in India, and I saw a lot of those small, close-knit communities that you're describing. And so I have exactly the reaction you're describing. When I think of community at some level, I want to reach for an oxygen mask because there's something very stultifying and oppressive and rigid about those communities. And as you say, it's not, you know, the truth is we are where we are because people have freely chosen. You know, these people who bemoan the de-churching of America and the rising secularization of America, which is, by the way, an enormous and dramatic trend that I talk about in the book. Well, if people attended church, it wouldn't be happening. You know, nobody's forcing people not to attend church. Nobody's forcing people to move from little towns to big cities, but they want to because of economic opportunity and freedom and the sense that they can be, you know, they can be themselves more. That desire for individual autonomy is very powerful. It's just that it seems that what happens is when people get it, they also experience this great sense of anxiety and loneliness. And so it's a push and pull. And I think that, you know, one way to think about it, like I don't want to sound, you know, simple. I'm sort of a rootless cosmopolitan and proud of it. I enjoy the autonomy, the individualism, the freedom I have. I have found a way of constructing a community of friends and like-minded people that I love and I wouldn't trade for the world. But I do recognize that, you know, this is a very powerful pull that people have. And you know, you can't dismiss it. You can't say, well, this is just, you know, this is a backward-looking phenomenon. The best thought I've had, Stephen, in sort of making people understand the value of this is to look at the people who don't have it and how hard they try to get it. The most powerful example we have staring at us in the face is Ukraine, right? Ukraine and Poland in 1990 had the same per capita GDP. Poland went west. Ukraine was not allowed to go west. It had to stay east, part of the Russian sphere of influence. Today, Poland is four times richer than Ukraine. Same per capita GDP in 1990, Poland is now four times richer. Now, it's not just wealth, but it's all the things that go along with having chosen to go west, having an open economy, having an open society, having democratic politics, having civil society. And the Ukrainians see that difference and care about it deeply enough that they're willing to die by the tens of thousands for it. They're willing to die even though they're up against an enemy that is five times bigger than they are by most measures. That, I think, gives you some sense. That is the heroic nature of liberalism that we sometimes take for granted.
That's fabulous, yes.
You're listening to Cambridge Forum, Age of Revolutions, Progress and Backlash from 1600 to the Present, with Fareed Zakaria and Professor Steven Pinker.
Let me ask one more question. The book is largely about global trends, but naturally it pays special attention to one country for which we have a parochial local interest, namely the United States. And in most places in the book where you talk about the post-war rules-based liberal order, you call it just the liberal order, the international liberal order. In one place, you fell back on the common expression American-led rules-based order, but mostly you leave out the American-led. And I've always been skeptical of the American-led part because in many ways the United States is kind of a rogue nation. We invaded Iraq without the authorization of the Security Council and over the opposition of allies like France and Germany. There's a Wikipedia page of treaties that the United States has not signed, and there's a long list of them. So we are kind of internationally not really the paragon of a rules-based international order. And domestically, a lot of the trends that have made life better for so many countries in the West The U.S. is something of a laggard. You mentioned that very recently the United States has caught up to most of the rest of our democratic wealthy peers in becoming more secular. The United States was a bit of a behind that trend for many years. But also, if you look at almost any index of human well-being, violent crime, self-reported happiness, suicide, obesity, incarceration, child mortality, maternal mortality, the United States is kind of okay. I mean, we're in the top 20, but we are the world's richest country, and as you note, we're the most, in many ways, the most technologically and scientifically advanced. So why is the United States kind of punching below its wealth in all of these measures, both internationally and domestically? Do you have opinions on the country that both you and I adopted, both of us being immigrants from the British Commonwealth?
So it's a very good point, and I think that it seems to me there are two different answers to it. Internationally, I think that the United States plays an unusual role in the world. It is the creator of this world order, without any question. Without the United States in 1945 having the disposition it had, we would not be in the world we're in. No European country would ever have created a world like this because they were all obsessed with their empires and trying to preserve their empires. And in fact, I'd go even further. If Franklin Roosevelt had not been president of the United States during World War II, I wonder whether we would have had this, because Franklin Roosevelt was the great liberal internationalist who happened to preside over the most powerful nation in the history of the world, in the greatest war in the history of the world, that destroyed much of the world and allowed the victor, the United States, to almost create de novo an international system. That opportunity will never occur again. There will never be a great power that powerful at that moment in history, and it's highly unlikely that it would have those preferences that Roosevelt had, which were very broadly kind of open, liberal, Wilsonian. And so that founding act, it seems to me, is incredibly important. Without the United States, you would not have had the whole system of the UN, the Bretton Woods, all of that, because the United States also agreed to underwrite a large part of it and undergird it with its power. It was the largest funder by far of all of those agencies for the first 30 or 40 years of their existence. So that piece of it, I don't think we can discount. Then there is a dynamic that takes shape, partly because of the Cold War, but partly because America plays this role as this kind of guarantor, where the United States almost believes, because it is the gatekeeper and guardian of that world, it doesn't have to play by those rules because it has broader responsibilities. It has to make sure that the bad guys are knocked down. And that means it has to sometimes act in ways that are, you know, even violations of those rules. And if you can't get a consensus on that, well, so be it. And of course, as we know, it has many times chosen poorly and made mistakes and done terrible things in doing that. And having that kind of license to operate as it wishes, it has very often acted in illiberal ways and acted in self-interested ways. I think that part of the dynamic is probably inherent in any leading power. You know, Britain thought of itself as the great liberal power while maintaining an incredibly rapacious empire at the same time. You know, so that piece of it maybe is at least more understandable. And I always think to myself, the way to think about that issue is the United States has been a terrible global hegemon, except when you think about all the others. Right? I mean, if the Soviet Union had won the Cold War, what would the world look like? If Hitler had won World War II, what would it look like? If Imperial Germany had won World War I, what would the world look like? So among the available alternatives, you know, the United States has done pretty darn well. And maybe I say this as an immigrant, but I do think it's really true. The history backs it up. The second piece, I think, is, you know, America is this very strange country. It is amazingly dynamic and innovative and can generate ideas and innovations and wealth on a scale that is difficult to understand and always able to renew itself. You know, so in 2008, the United States and Western Europe and Europe all went into this horrible global financial crisis. US and Eurozone economies were the same size in 2008. Today, the United States economy is twice the size of the Eurozone economy. If Britain were to join the United States as the 51st state, it would be the poorest state in the Union. It would be below Mississippi in per capita income. That's how well we have managed to thrive. But we are a ragged, unequal nation, and we tolerate enormous discrepancies within our system. And I think we kid ourselves that you need that for the dynamism. But we can be incredibly cruel in the way we treat the poorest people in America. I think that that's the real tragedy of the American system. We actually, you know, we talk so much about the middle class and the working class. The United States does a lot. And if you look at, you know, there are various ways of calculating the welfare state. The United States has a very large welfare state when you think about tax credits and all that kind of stuff. But very little of it is spent on the very poor. The very poor have terrible nutrition, terrible daycare, terrible education, because it's funded through property taxes. We are unique in the modern world in funding education through property taxes, which means poor communities get bad schools, rich communities get good schools. All of that seems to me unnecessary. It would actually help the country to have these people, these groups more integrated, more included. There's talent, you know, sprinkled randomly throughout America, and I think we miss a lot of the incredible talent that's out there. And if there was one flaw in the American system, I would try to fix it's that. And it's, you know, and the reason is we have this brutally competitive political system where they don't contribute much money to candidates, they don't vote that much, they don't write op-eds, they don't form PACs, and as a result, they are almost invisible in the American political landscape.
Indeed. I'm going to turn now in our last 10 minutes to some questions that were contributed from the audience. How will the age of revolutions impact our response to the climate and biodiversity crises? And if that isn't, once you've answered that, the second part is, and what is the end game on these issues?
I sometimes think about climate change as sort of like be above my pay grade, because if it's really going to happen at the scale that people think, you know, we're all screwed. And I don't know what more to say, because in a sense, yeah, but the way I would think about it is the challenge we face is we're clearly entering part of the backlash that I'm describing in this book is a return of nationalism and a turning away from global cooperation, even on something as simple as trade, which is a kind of win-win, actually. You know, if China gets richer, it actually makes America richer in the aggregate. But that is not how we're seeing things. We're seeing things much more narrow, nationalistic, chauvinistic terms. And that is a great danger when you think that the principal challenge we face is to find some way to cooperate on climate issues, because those affect us all. And one person's bad behavior affects everybody, and one person's good behavior affects everybody. And so finding a way to almost isolate that and say, can we just agree that we face this common danger and we want to, you know, to act together on it? And to be fair, a lot of countries are trying to do that. But I think that there should be a much greater emphasis on that rather than saying, we're just going to do what we can do. You know, there is a sort of, even in our climate policy now, there is an enormous amount of nationalism. We're saying we want to solve the climate crisis, but by the way, we're going to put tariffs on European and Chinese goods. We're going to subsidize American goods. If solar panels are made in China, they're bad. If they're made in America, they're good. And I understand the impulse, but you're kind of working at cross purposes then. Either this is a climate crisis that we have to all collectively tackle, or all we're trying to do is to screw the other countries and get there first in an economic race, which is actually not going to be one that will benefit climate change, you know, will help us ameliorate climate change.
Let me end up with one question that I think may sound impossible, but I think that you're perfectly equipped to answer it. You report beautifully on so many of our world's challenges, and you have a rare vantage point into the complexity of our world. What gives you hope as someone who deeply understands both the tragic and the beautiful in our world? Perfect question for Fareed Zakaria.
Well, look, at some level, you know, I'm a Pinkerian in that I do think things, you know, things do over time get better. And you just have to recognize that it's always complicated. There are always trade-offs. There's stuff that goes well and things that go badly, and you try to ameliorate one with the other. But we are, I think there's no doubt that we're in an age of backlash. You know, we've had seven straight years of declining democracy around the world, and the quality and quantity of democracy declining. We're closing down on trade. We're closing down on information flows. You look at our own, the quality of American democracy, and you worry about it when you think about this election coming up. You know, I know people always say that these are big consequential elections. Well, you know, this is an election in which for you have one of the people running is the first president in American history who tried to stop the peaceful transfer of power. That is not a normal thing. That has only happened once in American history. So, you know, there is real stuff one has to worry about. And I do think, you know, the future doesn't get better if you fatalistically assume it will. You have to fight for it. You have to work hard at it. You have to support the things you believe in. You have to get out there. And it's, you know, social media gives you this illusion that you are being virtuous by clicking a button, by pressing like. This is why, you know, when the Arab Spring happened, everyone is so surprised that Facebook didn't allow the Arab world to get transformed. You know, every Arab country that had the Arab Spring is now back to being a dictatorship. Well, guess what? Because pressing, you know, saying like on Facebook doesn't make you change the government, doesn't instill civil society, liberal democracy. It takes much more than that. But I do think what gives me hope is, at the end of the day, human beings do want to be free. Think about what I was saying about Ukraine. Think about those kinds of people who recognize what the value of freedom is, what the value of this liberal enlightenment project is that started in the West and has spread to so many parts of the world. I think it is very inspiring, and it is something we should be very much prouder of than we are. Bono, the singer, says that there should be, you know, many more songs written and flags flown for the European Union, because the European Union is not a bureaucracy, it's an idea. And the idea is that these countries that went to war for 500, 600 years have now found a way to live in peace and live in harmony and think of themselves as part of one larger project. These are incredibly inspiring ideas. And I don't think the battle is lost on that front. I think that at the end of the day, you know, the free world, if you want to put it that way, it's probably 60-70% of global GDP. What I sometimes wonder is why we have lost the confidence that came from it. You know, that sense of, I think we sometimes spend so much time thinking about all the imperfections in our society that we lose sight of the fact that this is a great achievement. We should feel incredible pride in it. We should try to, you know, make it even better. But in the grand sweep of history, this is one of the great disruptions, one of the great revolutions that has taken place, a revolution that liberated the human spirit, the, you know, individuals. And as long as we can fight for it, I think in the long run, we will win.
Fareed, on behalf of the entire audience, I thank you for a fantastic, considered book and performance. Thank you for reading.
Cambridge Forum is made possible through the generosity of Herbert and Dorothy Vetter, the Lowell Institute, Mass Cultural Council, Cambridge Community Foundation, and of course all of you. So if you want to donate or sign up to our list, please visit the website cambridgeforum.org. Thank you all for joining us, and I hope to see you all soon.